Good morning.
Good morning.
Did you enjoy that rain this morning?
Rain?
No. Well, I had drops on my pickup. It must have rained, surely. So.
No, it just thundered.
Just thundered? Well, I bought a rain gauge and I need to take it back. It's just not working. One of these days. Well, at any rate, we can't complain about it being cold. And we will, I'm sure, have some more rain eventually. This morning, we are studying in Isaiah chapter 60. This is a chapter which looks forward to a bright future, to a time whenever God's blessing will abound, and the world will be very different. We started reading here a little bit last week. I'll start again with verse 1. Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. But the Lord will arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. Lift up thine eyes round about, and see. As they gather themselves together, they come to thee. Thy sons shall come from far, and thy daughters shall be nursed at thy side. Then thou shalt see and flow together, and thine heart shall fear and be enlarged, because the abundance of the sea shall be converted unto thee. The forces of the Gentiles shall come unto thee. The multitudes of camels shall cover thee, the dromedaries of Midian and Ephah. All they from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and incense. They shall show forth the praises of the Lord. Okay, so Isaiah is speaking in all sorts of metaphoric ways of signs of abundance and blessing. As always, we kind of have to translate some things into our world. We don't view a lot of these words that he uses here as particularly exciting or blessed situations. I would not be particularly or feel particularly blessed to come out one morning and find my yard full of camels. I don't know about you, but I can think of several undesirable side effects of that sort of thing. First of all, there'd probably be a lot less green, right? Because they eat. But we won't go any further than that. Anyway, in the ancient world, the abundance of camels, these caravans, brought wealth. It was commerce. It was prosperity. In the ancient world, localities, we talk about real estate. What's real estate? It's location, 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 right? Certainly prosperity in the ancient world was closely connected to where you were situated. If you were in a location where people had to pass through your city in order to get where they were going, that meant business, that meant money, that meant commerce. And the camels were one of the prime means of transporting those things over the land. Now, notice here, he couples gold and incense. They shall bring gold and incense. And that speaks of a somewhat different situation than we have in our world. In some cases, incense was as valuable as gold in the ancient world. They often had trouble with odor control. And they didn't have many of the modern technologies that we do. And odor matters. It does. And if you have to be exposed and constantly oppressed by odors that you can't control, you might pay some money for some incense. And so it's just kind of interesting. I mean, people sometimes pay a lot of money for perfume nowadays, but nothing like gold in a value point of view. But that's a reference to things of great value. They shall bring gold and incense, and they shall so show forth the praises of the Lord. So one thing that we see coming out of this chapter is what draws them to Zion, what draws them to respond in this way, is the goodness and the blessing of God, which has been poured out on his people. And so he uses lots of pictures of this drawing, lots of pictures of the movement of wealth and people in that direction. And so this, of course, is quite the contrast from the things that the nation had experienced. Rather than being blessed by the Gentiles, they had been taken into captivity. They had been decimated. They had been destroyed. And so this is a reversal of all that. And of course, it was fulfilled to some extent under Cyrus, whenever the Jews were allowed to return. And I sometimes slip into a modern vocabulary. Jews is a more modern term. And of course, it's becoming the reality by the time of the return from exile, because the term Jews is derived from Judah, and it was largely the tribe of Judah that was still around to be taken into Babylonian captivity. But anyway, in a more general sense, the children of Israel are promised a restoration. And so we see these different elements of wealth and abundance and blessing that are returning. The flow has been reversed. It's going in that direction. Different nationalities referred to here. We have basically nations which are located in the direction of the Arabian Peninsula, Midian, Ephah, and Sheba would be essentially modern Yemen. And these were nations that which were very influential in the caravan trade, the spice and gold trade in the ancient world. The next verse, all the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered together unto thee, and the rams of Nebaioth shall minister unto thee. It's my understanding that the Nebaioth term would be connected to the wealth associated with what we perhaps have seen pictures of. Have you ever seen pictures of the city of Petra? That incredible stone carving into it. Actually, it's actually into the walls of the canyon it's sort of a valley in southern Jordan, and that region is supposedly what's being referred to here. They shall come up with acceptance on mine altar, and I will glorify the house of my glory. The next two verses, verse 8 really sparked my imagination, but most commentators actually connect it with verse 9. Verse 8 says, "And who are these that fly as a cloud and as the doves to their windows?" And so if you take that by yourself, it's like, I wonder what Isaiah was seeing there, right? Maybe airplanes, which we are quite familiar with, but which he wasn't. But the commentators always connect that with verse 9 and understand that to be seen, as it were, sails on a ship. Surely the isles will wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring thy sons from far, their silver and their gold with them, unto the name of the Lord thy God and the Holy One of Israel, because he hath glorified thee. And the ships of Tarshish refer to the biggest ships, those that are capable of carrying the largest loads commercially. Sometimes the term is thought to refer to the regions of Spain, and clear the other end of the Mediterranean Ocean, Mediterranean Sea. And so they are, as it were, in our day, the comparison would be the huge container ships that you see if you've been to the one of the port cities, see them coming in. Stacked high and incredibly big and long. And so while the Gentiles in the past conflicts have torn down the walls of Jerusalem, in verse 10, "And the sons of strangers shall build up thy walls, and their kings shall minister unto thee. For in my wrath I smote thee, but in my mercy, in my favor have I found mercy upon thee." So Rachel and I took a short trip this week to Ohio, and quite often when we do those trips, I try to find some book to listen to educate myself over the miles and keep myself awake too. And I listened to at least part of a book by Mike Pompeo, if you remember that name. He was under President Trump. He was first head of the CIA and then our Secretary of State. And, you know, one of the interesting things about reading or listening to some of these books of contemporary people is they sometimes give you some insight into how things work behind the scenes on a world level. And, of course, any book you read from somebody in the Trump administration gives you a very different picture than what you got on the news. So it's a nice contrast just from that standpoint. But in reading this, in listening to that and reading through this chapter, I just reflected on some of the incredible things that go on behind the scenes on a world scale that we don't see every day, we don't experience. And it is amazing the position that Israel has come to occupy in our world, and the fact that it's only been 1948, Israel again became a state after almost 2,000 years of having been not a state. And so 1948 doesn't seem all that long ago to me, but I caught myself almost saying after over 50 years now, but it's been well over 50 years. Yeah, it's going on 75. So time is a matter of perspective, isn't it? I remember some years back, whenever Matt's boys were small, they saw a picture, I believe it was an airplane, that had a date on it, and it was like, early 2000s, and they remarked, boy, that's old. And so it all depends on where you came into the picture as to your sense of time. But my point is this. Israel has very rapidly moved into a position of prominence in our world. There have certainly been billions of dollars of Gentile money that have gone into producing the Israeli state and supporting it. The United States alone has been a huge, huge supporter of the every aspect of the Jewish state, and in particular their military. So the walls of Jerusalem don't make much difference anymore, literally, right? They're not going to keep anybody out. But walls speak of defense in general. And so in Isaiah seeing the walls rebuilt with Gentile efforts and money, what he is seeing there is the restoration of the defense of the city. And so, yes, absolutely. We have seen God's blessing on them in that way in our very days. And it would have been totally inconceivable, 50, 100 years before that. That would have been a hard thing to see coming. Therefore, thy gates shall be open continually. They shall not be shut night or day, that men may bring unto thee the forces of the Gentiles, and that their kings may be brought. For the nation and kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted. And I think we have to understand the picture that he draws here, not limit it to the political nation of Israel, the state of Israel, but to recognize that it is the ideal Israel that we see fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And so there is also this aspect of Christ and his kingdom, his becoming full realization of his kingdom. It is not to the Jewish state that all will be subject, but it is to Christ as the fulfillment of the ideal Israel that all will bow or be utterly wasted. Once again, in prophecy, we see not a simple expression of every detail of the future, but we see an indication that God knows what's going to happen. God knows, and he's revealed it in a form to his prophets. And so we get metaphors, we get whispers, we get suggestion, and looking back, we can see God knows all, and he has revealed it unto his prophets in a sometimes veiled way. But we can see that, yes, that is something that he brought about. So he continues here with different images of the kinds of good things, the kinds of blessing that he will bring about. The glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee. The fir tree, the pine tree, the box tree together, to beautify the place of thy sanctuary. And I will make the place of thy feet glorious. In the ancient world, Lebanon was known for its timber. Today, Lebanon is not particularly a glorious place. I heard on the news this morning that they are suffering from absolutely horrendous inflation. And of course, for years, they have been fractured by different militant groups that have fought for power. Hezbollah is particularly powerful in the southern part of Lebanon. So the glory of Lebanon today is a stretch in our minds. So he's speaking more of the ancient image of Lebanon, of a place of rich resources in timber, which were used in Solomon's timber, and as well we have found that the Egyptians imported a lot of Lebanese timber into their projects. Some of the archaeology there has uncovered timber which has been traced back to Lebanon, the glory of Lebanon. And there is something that seems intrinsically glorious about huge trees soaring to the sky. If you've ever had the opportunity to walk up to one of the redwoods out west, you'll say, yeah, I understand that image, the glory. So he says it's going to come to beautify the place of my sanctuary, and I will make the place of my feet glorious. The sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee, and all they that despise thee shall bow themselves down at the soles of thy feet, and they shall call thee the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. I don't know about you, but I would hate to be in the shoes of the regime which is currently in Iran, which constantly calls for the annihilation of Israel. I don't know if they don't read Isaiah or what, but I'm just thinking that's not a place I'd like to be in. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Whereas thou hast been forsaken and hated, so that no man went through thee, I will make thee an eternal excellency, a joy of many generations. And then a highly metaphorical verse. Thou shalt also suck the milk of the Gentiles, and shalt suck the breast of kings. And thou shalt know that I, the Lord, am thy Savior and thy Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. Okay, and so while that is sort of a striking verse, it simply is pointing to the sustenance that comes in the physical sense from milk. So the Gentiles and kings shall provide sustenance to the blessed ones of God. Thou shalt know that I, the Lord, am thy Savior and thy Redeemer. And so if you are in a place that is destitute, if you are a place that no one wants to be associated with you, no one wants to pass through you, the thought that the mighty of the earth, that the affluent, that the billionaires will in fact be the ones whose goods you enjoy is kind of far-fetched. How could that possibly be? How could that come to pass? Well, Only through God's power can that happen. For brass I will bring gold, and for iron I will bring silver, and for wood brass, and for stones iron. Okay, so here's an exchange which reflects the value of things in just their commodity form. As it turns out, there are some cases where you wouldn't want gold for iron. Gold doesn't have the strength of iron. A gold sword would not be much good. Pretty to look at, but not very useful in battle. But as a commodity, as far as the price per pound is concerned, these things are rated accordingly. Gold for brass, silver for iron, brass for wood, iron for stones. And it's kind of interesting to me that iron ends up so far down the scale there, because to make iron in the ancient world took a lot of effort, took a lot of fire. Iron doesn't occur naturally in its pure form. It's always, it's most always refined from an oxide. And so iron oxide is rust. It's a long ways from rust to a steel anything. And so it takes a lot of charcoal and somebody pumping some bellows and the right combination of other agents in order to refine iron from its ore. But if you're good at it, if you do it in a big way, you can make that iron out of just red rock. You know, most iron ore is reddish. And so something which before seemed almost worthless, you can build something with it as far as a building's concerned, but nothing like gold, you can extract it from that raw material. Whereas gold occurs naturally in a fairly pure form. Sometimes they do purify it further, but it's not usually in chemical combination with anything else. And so it expresses an interesting rating, a ranking of value with these different materials. And so I will do these things. I will also make thy officers peace and thine extractors righteousness. Boy, now that's a striking image. If you live in our world, and you do if you're here, you perhaps have encountered authority figures. I think we're somewhat sheltered here in our locality, but more and more we find pressing on us people in places of authority that are not bent on peace. Thine extractors, I think he's referring to that whole category of people, from tax collectors to toll collectors, people who raise revenue for the government, thine extractors righteousness, I will make them that. That would be a beautiful thing, wouldn't it? We're constantly encountering stories of people who have been ill-used, and heard recently about a city that had taken a lady's property because she was delinquent on her taxes, sold her property, and kept all the money. So she owed maybe $2,500. The property bought $20,000-$30,000, and they kept it all. She had to take the case with the help of some kind organization, I believe all the way to the Supreme Court, in order to have that case remedied. Well, that's horrible. That's terrible. How can that happen? Well, you give people power who aren't righteous. That can happen. That will happen. If they have the opportunity, for them, righteousness is doing what's in their best interest. But God says, I will make thine officers peace, thine extractors righteousness. We all acknowledge that if we're going to have a decent society, if we're going to have decent roads, decent infrastructure in terms of sewer and water and gas, we all have to help pay for it. That's something I think we accept. But it's totally another thing whenever you see wastefulness and skimming and all sorts of unjust practices that are the result of a fallen human race in put in places of power. We long for the righteousness and the peace of God, the justice that he brings. So he says, violence shall no more be heard in thy land, wasting or destruction within thy borders. But thou shalt call thy walls salvation and thy gates praise. The sun shall be no more thy light by day, neither for brightness shall the moon give light unto thee. But the Lord shall be unto thee an everlasting light, and thy God thy glory. Oh, what a beautiful thought. And we see then that verse picked up in Revelation chapter 22, verse 5. And there shall no longer be any night, and they shall not have need of the sun, of a lamp, nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God shall illumine them, and they shall reign forever and ever. One thing that's always amazed me about Revelation, the book of Revelation, is that you can find almost all of the images there in Old Testament prophecy. And so here we see this one from Isaiah chapter 60. Thy sun shall no more go down, neither shall thy moon withdraw itself. For the Lord shall be thine everlasting light, and the days of thy mourning shall be ended. Thy people also shall be righteous. They shall inherit the land forever, the branch of my planting, the work of my hands, that I may be glorified. A little one shall be a thousand, and a small one a strong nation. I, the Lord, will hasten it in his time. At the end of the day, it is this hope, the hope expressed here, that gives us rest, I think. As we go through life, we have different goals. We're all in different positions in our life. Some of you are looking forward to the first experience of various kinds. Some of us have had the first and the second and the third.
Looking forward to the last.
Looking forward to the last. But at any rate, I think as you go through life, as much joy, as much anticipation, as much fulfillment as there is to be had, there is, at the end of the day, a peace which comes from looking beyond everything you will experience here, of realizing that we are made by divine hands to anticipate more than this world can supply. This world can't satisfy our soul. And so as the branch of his planting, as the work of his hands, we long for that body that will be redeemed, and for a world where his righteousness and his peace in fact pervades every space. It really saddens me when I look at developments in our world and I see people who put all of their energy into one cause or another that they think will bring them happiness. People who try to change the very essence of what they are with the idea that I will be happy if I do this. Go through this procedure. Go through this experience. Go to this place. All sorts of possibilities, you see. And with the anticipation, I will be happy then. I will be satisfied. I will be fulfilled. And, you know, there is this little ditty you hear that, you know, everybody has a right to express themselves, to find their own fulfillment. Well, the problem, of course, is that our drive for fulfillment in so many cases is misdirected. It's aimed at things which can't fulfill, which can't satisfy. And there's a certain ignorance that you see displayed all the time by people that want to support the desires that are not based on reality, that are not based on happiness, and to affirm a drive which will not satisfy. It's emptiness. Well, God has more for us. And we see the promise of that here. And it is in realizing that we are the work of his hands, the branch of his planting. We are destined to share in his glory if we choose him. And only there will we find true fulfillment. So in some ways, this chapter is challenging. It has such a wide range of metaphors that sometimes we struggle to connect with in our world. But it is throughout a chapter which promises of a time whenever God's blessing shall be brought to fruition. And we have seen some fulfillment of this in small ways along the way, in a huge way in Christ when he came to this earth the first time, but in a much greater completed way when he returns. And we must remember that although Isaiah uses physical images here to create his metaphors, that ultimately God's blessing is so much greater than camels and dromedaries. gold and silver. Yes.
I'm sometimes intrigued by often hearing that Jesus himself used metaphors of planting or sowing seed, farming aspect. And when it says that they will inherit the land forever, from a farming aspect, that is such a rich, there's so much you can do with land.
Yeah.
So massive. And, you know, after being on that farm and the highways, you see what's there, the potential that's there, just the land. Anyway, it's a metaphor.
And of course, that forever part, compared to the reality of what the Jewish nation had experienced, where the invading armies took away their land, took away their homes, destroyed all that they had built. That is an exceptionally rich promise, isn't it? You know, something that I've thought about various times, when you think of all the effort that goes into building something. I know probably most all of you have experienced a little bit of the effort that goes into building or remodeling. It takes a lot of work. It really does. And when you think on a historical basis of in all of human history, all the things that have been built, and how that more often than not, whenever the conquerors come in, they destroy it. That's the first thing they do. They destroy everything you work so hard to build. And it's like, well, is that smart? Why do we do that? Well, it's a power act, right? So if you build a great thing, that stands as an eternal monument to you. And if I'm trying to appropriate all that you have into my power, I don't want monuments to you standing around. And of course, the only reason the pyramids are still standing is they're just a little bit too much trouble to tear down. They're solid after all, so it's not like you can push them over. But you can see how that great structures are a testimony to whoever built them. There are many civilizations that we know about in one way or another in history, but because they didn't do anything that was permanent enough for us to examine, they're not even on our radar many times. You know, they perhaps didn't have a written language, or if they did, they wrote it on banana leaves or whatever, so it didn't survive. There's just nothing to refer to them in the record. And so, even though it's a terrible waste, it is the human way to destroy what came before in order to establish yourself. And wow, what a waste. You think right now about the waste of the nation of Ukraine. You know, you had years and years of infrastructure and buildings and electricity and sewer and water and roads and bridges. You know how long it takes to build a bridge? I don't know how long it takes over there, but here it seems to take a long time. And so not just one bridge, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of structural elements of their world have just been bombed to pieces. What a waste. And to what end? You know, Well, that's the way of man. God doesn't view that kind of future for us. He wants things to be different. And
you'd think the invading enemies would want to utilize those things themselves.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a sad record that we have left, but it's a glorious hope that God offers us if we will, in fact, embrace His righteousness. Anything else here in chapter 60 that you'd like to comment on?
I noticed in NAS it uses the word frankincense instead of incense.
Okay.
Do you know what the difference is, or is it?
Well, frankincense would be an instance, one type of. Of incense.
One type of incense.
Let's see, where is that verse? It was early on, wasn't it? Oh, I saw it. Thank you. So let's see if we have any helps here that. Okay, so it appears that the Hebrew word is most often translated frankincense. Out of 21 times in the Old Testament, 15 of them are translated frankincense. Most of the other translations we usually look at do use frankincense. So have you ever smelled frankincense? Yeah. Seems like one time you can buy that kind of stuff online, you know. I guess it's real. Pardon me? Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember the experience at the moment, but it didn't smell bad. I know some people swear by it as a cure for cancer as well, skin cancer, but I don't have any information on that. But I do know that in the ancient world, different incenses were highly prized in order to combat the unpleasantness of natural odors. Well, according to my timekeeping device, we are out of time. So I will stop there. Thank you for your attention.
Jesus knows when I am lonely. He knows each pain. He sees each tear. He understands each lonely heartache. He understands because he cares. My Jesus knows just what I need. Oh, yes, he knows just what I need. He satisfies and every need supplies. Yes, he knows just what I need. My Jesus knows when I am burdened. He knows how much my heart can bear. He lifts me up when I am sinking and brings me joy beyond compare. My Jesus knows just what I need. Oh, yes, he knows just what I need. He satisfies my every need, supplies. Yes, he knows just what I need. When other friends seem to forget me, when skies are dark, when hope is gone, by faith I feel his arms around me and hear him say, you're not alone. My Jesus knows just what I need. Oh, yes, he knows just what I need. He satisfies supplies. Yes, he knows just what I need.